thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, featuring Tom Scheinfeld, Mills Kelly, and Dan Cohen.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus, episode 51, for the 28th of January, 2010. The inevitable iPad. Well, welcome to another edition of Digital Campus. I'm sure for our regular listeners, you'll all be wondering already, where's Dan? Well, for those of you who didn't listen all the way through to our the end of our last episode, we're going to be doing something new for the next 50 episodes, I guess. This is our 51st episode. We're going to be rotating the hosting duties to give Dan a little bit of a rest. But rest assured, Dan Cohen is here with us today. Hi, Dan.
I am. Gosh, I was going to make a joke that I was doing my best Tom Scheinfeld impression, but you've already spilled the beans. So.
you're suitably relaxed. You've got your feet up.
I am. My feet are up. I have a large cup of coffee, and I'm ready to talk.
Okay, great, great. We're also here with our third regular, Mills Kelly. How you doing, Mills?
I'm doing pretty well. Doing pretty well.
Good, and we're fortunate today to have with us one of our irregulars, one of our illustrious irregulars, Jennifer Howard from the Chronicle of Higher Ed. Hi, Jen.
Hi, Tom.
Well, so I guess we have to say that we're recording this on the 28th of January, and yesterday I think we all saw Steve Jobs stand up on a stage in San Francisco and hold an object up above his head, the much-awaited, I guess we now know the name, the Apple iPad, what do we call it? It's a tablet, maybe. It's a large iPhone or a large iPod Touch, but I don't think we can get away with not talking about that today, so why don't we jump right into it. Jen, what's your thoughts on this? Do you think this is a big story for, let's say, the industry in general, for computing in general, and is it a big story for higher ed and cultural heritage?
Well, it might be. I think it's a little too early to tell. I mean, the thing is certainly beautiful, you know, as you'd expect from Apple. It's got a lot of appeal. The visuals are great. I'm guessing it's really nice to hold and work with. It seems to have some possibilities as an e-reader. That's kind of yet to be seen, I think. But there are a lot of people who are hoping that this may free up some of that market, because a lot of people who might be interested in a Kindle don't really want to just get a dedicated e-reader yet. They want a device that could do a lot of different kinds of things, which the iPad clearly can. I don't like that name, by the way. There's some big publishers already signed on to be part of this iBook store that Jobs talked a little bit about yesterday, although not a whole lot. It's yet to be seen about whether scholarly publishers, academic publishers are going to have a big part in this. I'm sure they're interested, but I haven't yet heard whether they're talking to Apple and what kind of possibilities there. Also remains to be seen whether students are going to want to shell out, you know, another at least $500. I mean, that's a pretty good entry point for a device like this, but for a student, that's still a lot of money. And if you want to get it, you know, the souped up version, you're getting close to $800 or $900. That's starting to look pretty pricey for a student who probably already has a laptop, may want to read ebooks on that if possible. You know, so I think there are a lot of questions still, but it's promising. It's interesting.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I think that it is interesting. One of the things about it that I'm a little cautious about is the pricing. I think it came in at least the basic version lower than a lot of people expected, but I think to have an always-on internet connection, it's going to be a subscription model, whereas the Amazon Kindle has its WhisperNet, where it's included, the lifetime internet connection, EVDO connection is included in the price of the device. And this is going to have, I believe, a $30 a month plan attached to it. And so it'll be interesting to see if people are willing to shell out another $30 a month in addition to their telephone, their cell phone subscription to have a kind of a third device. Dan, what do you think about this?
Well, just on that point, I think that as Jobs said, you know, they have already gotten 75 million people used to this interface. And I think for students, the interface is probably because, you know, iPhones with their $100 a month plans are expensive. The, you know, the notion of adding, as you said, the subscription is tough. But they are used to the iPod Touch, and I think they're used to syncing their iPod Touch to a device, whether that be a PC or a Mac. And so I think that he really, you know, I was wondering which end of the spectrum Apple would go toward, the sort of full-purpose computing device that a laptop is, or toward the iPod or iPhone. And clearly he's sort of chosen to go toward that side, which I think is a pretty interesting choice. I do think, you know, you could get away with just paying the $499 and doing pretty much everything you wanted on it at that price, as long as you have, you know, another computer to hook it up to get content onto it. And I think also, just while we're on this, on initial reactions, I was surprised that they chose to kind of do the big iPod Touch, but I actually think that they've learned more than I thought from the Kindle, in that they didn't want a device that had Windows on it, not Windows, Bill Gates Windows. But I think that they learned a lot from the Kindle, and I think they were surprised, you know, that there was this big quote from Steve Jobs last year that he was sort of mocking how, you know, ebooks are, you know, he was mocking the Kindle, he was mocking the notion of ebooks.
Nobody reads anymore.
Nobody reads. But I think what is kind of revolutionary about this device is, okay, yes, it is a bigger iPod Touch, but I think actually for academia, it is a pretty nice device, in that because it doesn't have Windows, when you go into, at least judging from the screenshots and the video I've seen, when you go into, let's say, the iBooks reader, it occupies the entire screen. There's no menus around it. And in that way, they have learned a lot. I think if they had come out with something that was sort of, you know, the MacBook Air, but it's just the screen, but it has lots of windows and stuff, you get that distraction. And I think that they've learned a lot from the experience, both of the touch interface, which is a single program at a time device, and also from the Kindle, which is a kind of single program at a time device. And so I think, in a sense, you know, there was a lot of emphasis on, well, this is the mid-size thing, you know, emphasizing size between your small screen and your big screen. But I actually think it's a, where are you using this device? And I actually think it's an armchair device. It's for the things you would do on the couch, as they kept showing in lots of videos with their designers.
Steve was even sitting in an armchair.
That's right. I hope not in an off-color way, but, you know, this is a device that discriminates against people without knees, you know. And I think, but that is important, that, and there's a lot of things that I do that are armchair experience, and that I don't want my Twitter updates sort of overlaying on top of what I'm trying to read. So there's a casual reading experience that I want on the computer that is non-immersive, that is multitasking. And I think that they've decided, actually, I think a lot from the reading experience, that they needed something that kind of fits into that realm of immersion, where there's no menus around it, there's nothing to distract, there's no windowing, there's no 2.5 dimensions, which is the kind of interface we've had for 30 years in computing, where you can slide things past each other. And I think they wanted, I think very consciously, that there's no multitasking here. You go into something to watch a show or read a book or play a game, and it's not going to be that multi-computing device. And I think that actually may be a plus for certain academic uses.
Yeah, I think it's a smart choice. I think we can clearly sort of say, now that we've seen this, and, you know, all the questions about how it's going to work and how elegant it's going to be and all of that, I think some of that remains to be seen. But I think we can clearly say now that this is a media device. This is not a computer. This is not a productivity device. This is really a media viewer. I think it's much more the descendant of the iPod than it is of the Macintosh. I think we can probably say that for sure. Mills, what are your thoughts on this?
You know, I'm going to be really interested to see how the computing pieces of it work, because as you know, my big and anybody listening to the podcast over the last year knows that my big criticism of the Kindle is that it has no computing capability. It's really only a book access device, and that's a criticism coming from the perspective of the of possible classroom use. I think that this device has a lot of potential for classroom use because of some of the things that Dan just talked about, and that is that it is sort of it's not a multitasking device. It is, I mean, you're going to be able to, it seems, flip back and forth between different apps. But so one of them, I want to see how the virtual keyboard feature works, because if students can take notes in that way and then flip back over to the slides that I want them to look at or something like that, then I think that's going to be really nice. And I like the size of it because it'll fit on the average college classroom desk. Right. This is one of the great advantages of the netbook, is that it will fit on the average desktop that our desktop, like wooden desktop or polycarbonate desktop that our students have to use, where a laptop won't. It's just too big often. The long battery life is great from that perspective, because then, you know, you don't have all the students with the laptops walking into class and looking for the plugs in the wall so that they can have to sit over there at that end of the room. So I think that it has a lot of sort of ergonomic advantages or physical advantages for classroom use, but also from a pedagogical standpoint, I think devices like this, and I think like the iPhone, this is going to be sort of the entry device, and we're going to see lots of other versions getting spawned by other manufacturers that do, you know, similar kinds of things. I think it has some real potential for classroom use. So I'm pretty excited about it in that respect.
You know, I think you mentioned that there are going to be other devices that look like this, and I think that's absolutely right. I don't think there's any reason why HTC or someone else couldn't come out tomorrow with an Android device that does more or less exactly the same thing. So I think we're probably going to see, if this is successful, a lot of copycat devices probably running the Android platform. One of the things that I read actually was that the medical industry is actually looking at this as something that doctors would carry around the hospital, doctors and nurses, and would provide them with real-time information about patients and about and access to medical information. And I was thinking about that, and I can actually imagine a use for this in some other kind of field educational settings. I can imagine geology students carrying one of these out in the field, or archaeologists carrying one of these out in the field and interacting with databases that are back at the home base.
I can tell you somebody else who will use them, and that is, you know, in the hospital example, I think is a really good one. I spent a lot of time in hospitals the last couple of years, as you guys know, with my parents, and so I've seen how the medical profession is using all sorts of, as they say, telemetry these days. But so a device like this, I think, would be great in that. But another group of people I can immediately imagine using a device like this are the guys and gals who have to come to a building to deal with the phone wires. You know, they go to the main box, and right now some of them actually use glasses that have holographic displays so that they, because, you know, they're looking at 7,000 color-coded wires. And so something like this for, you know, any sort of really technical job, I think this is going to be a real advantage for, just especially because of the bright colors and the clear display.
Yeah, I think it's still one of the things that probably remains to be seen is where this ends up in relation to the Kindle and what, how it changes the ebook marketplace. And I think that's probably, you know, for researchers and scholars, I think that's a big question. I mean, there are some things about it that are probably more attractive in the ebook space, and then I think there are some things that could be problematic. Jen, what's your thought about this device as an ebook reader?
Well, a couple of things occurred to me yesterday. One is that it's, you know, since it uses the open format EPUB, that seems to be promising. And again, we don't know enough yet to know how promising exactly. But, you know, with Kindle, you've got this proprietary format, I think it's called AZW, And with the iPad, it's, you know, in theory at least, could go and upload a PDF you found anywhere from, you know, Project Gutenberg or wherever. And I don't know if Apple has yet said that that's going to happen, but at least that opens the possibility. So as far as the, you know, the question of DRM, this really could open things up, I think. The other thing is that with the possibility of color, you know, the Kindle right now, maybe it's fine for reading Jane Eyre, but, you know, what if, you know, if you want to look at a book that has, you know, it's an art history book that has illustrations with color photographs, you know, if you can get past the permissions thicket and get an ebook version of that, this device really could open up possibilities for different kinds of ebooks that we haven't seen yet. So I think it's very promising. I hope Apple takes the time soon to really explain how iBooks is going to work, and, you know, exactly does it seem more open than it's actually going to be?
Isn't that a critical question? That's what I was thinking about too yesterday, Jen. Is, you know, when they launched the iPod and iTunes, you could still, let's say, put a CD into your Mac that you owned and drag and drop those MP3 files, or have it load those in. Or you could just get an MP3 file, of course, which is why there was so much piracy. And I think part of the reason that the iPod took off was you could just grab MP3 files from the internet and stick them into iTunes. You know, if iBooks allows you to drag and drop any EPUB file in, mm-hmm. well, then all of a sudden you've got a device that actually, you know, this is already happening with the Nook and the Sony Reader, where they have access to the million public domain books that Google hosts in EPUB format. But then it also allows any publisher to really get an EPUB in there. And, you know, that's I guess, the real question is how open that piece is going to be. I do want to say one point on the comparison with the Kindle, which is that, I mean, everyone in the reaction has said, oh, but the Kindle's still the best for long-form reading. But I actually think this is missing some of the point. First of all, we haven't seen the screen, so I bet you the screen is going to look a lot nicer than your average laptop screen, because it uses this technology that evidently is a little bit brighter and also reads very similarly from any angle, so which I think is probably important for the feeling of permanence that a page has. I don't doubt that the e-ink probably has a kind of better long-form reading still. But I think that's missing a bunch of things. If you look carefully at the ebook interface that the Kindle doesn't have, that's really critical to reading. So some of the things I saw immediately were, you can tell how far along you are in the book in a way that is familiar to us, because it shows the pages beyond the page that you're on. Mm-hmm. So if you go to, for instance, openlibrary.org and pull up a full text book, they have something called the flip book experience, which is exactly like this. Mm-hmm. And you feel turning the pages. And I think that those little subtle cues, and this is where I think, Tom, you're right, there's going to be an Android version of it, but it's not going to get these little details right. And these little details are going to be really critical to the experience of reading. So that feeling of how far along I am in the book, it's also, by all reports, a very fast interface. And one thing that the Kindle does very poorly, and which really for me is a problem for academic reading, if I were to, let's say, download a bunch of Victorian books that I wanted to write an article on, is the ability to skim. You cannot skim on a Kindle. Mm-hmm. And this thing, you look at the video. TechCrunch had a great video of them just skimming through a book. I mean, you literally can take it as if it's a paper book and just flip your hands as fast as it can, and the pages will just flip by. You can jump to chapters much more easily. So I think actually there's going to be pieces of this that will feel like it's a better ebook reader, even though perhaps if you're sitting there for 4 hours, you might get some eye strain. So I think the jury's out on, you know, how ideal the Kindle is versus this.
One thing I wanted to mention before we move on at some point is the pricing options for books that you will buy for the iPad too. It looks like Apple may be more willing to negotiate with publishers than Amazon has been, which could be really, really attractive to publishers who are, you know, going nuts having to let Amazon charge $9.99 for a book when the hardcover will be, you know, $25 or $30. So if Apple is really more flexible in terms of its pricing, that could really attract more kinds of publishers and make iBooks a more attractive option for some of them than Amazon has sometimes been.
Also, I think on the pricing question, you know, Tom was talking about the expense of having the always on with the iPad, but also your cell phone account. I think the wise move would be to have student packages, you know, for the AT&T to have some sort of student package where they were able to bundle it together, because, you know, this is a drug, and once they've become addicted to the drug, then they will stay with it after college. And so this would be a really good way to get lots of these in the hands of students, because then I think they'll suck up the price of the investment in the hardware if they can in some way combine the plan while they're enrolled as students.
Yeah, I think one thing that was, I think, a surprise to some people too was this question of AT&T, where this is going to be an AT&T only device, at least for the short term, which I think surprised some people who were thinking that the iPhone should be coming out on other platforms shortly. It's kind of an interesting thing that Apple ended up sort of in the arms of AT&T again, which has, I think, caused it some problems. I think we're going to have to watch this when these come on the market and one of us goes and splurges and gets one in his hands or her hands, we'll I'm sure be revisiting this and revisiting it again. So there are some other stories that we've been kind of tracking over the course of the last couple of weeks. One of them, Jen, you wrote about in the Chronicle of Higher Ed, story about Cornell proposing a new model for Archive. For people who don't know, Archive is an open access repository of pre-published or preprint physics, mostly physics papers, that's been going on for many years now. And it looks like Cornell is asking for the scientific community, other institutions, to help them cover the costs of maintaining what has now become, I think, a vital resource for the early dissemination and quick dissemination of scientific papers. Could you say maybe a little bit more about that, Jen, and where you see this impacting the larger field of open access and scholarly publishing?
Sure. First, as you said, this repository is critical to these fields: physics, computer science, quantitative biology, statistics. It's really the go-to place to keep up with the latest research, get your research out there. Which, of course, in those fields, the turnaround time is very important. They want the latest information. They want it fast. So it's a really widely used resource. It's probably the most successful repository, at least that I know of, in terms of really being integral to the field and the scholarship. But it's not cheap to run. According to Cornell, it costs them about $400,000 a year. Now
do you have any sense what that comes from, Jen? I mean, clearly it must be staff, right? I mean, it can't.
It's got to be staff.
Probably so. I don't know about, server, what sort of server capacity it requires and all that. It does seem like a high figure, but they've been very public about it. So I guess I'm, willing
to
accept.
I don't doubt
figure.
It. I'm just sort of curious.
I should ask them. Next time I talk to them, I'll ask. And for a single institution, even a big one like Cornell, that's a good chunk of change, given that, hundreds of institutions use this. I mean, this is, faculty all over the world are using this resource, and it's really not essentially fair to ask one institution to continue to support this critical resource. So Cornell seems to have gone about it really smartly. I think they made up a list of their top 200 institutional users, the institutions whose faculty were tapping the resource most often, and approached them before they made this announcement and said, look, this is really too expensive for us. Can you guys kick something in? They're suggesting $4,000 apiece for the top institutions, and my understanding is that most of those have said that they will participate. Now, that's not going to entirely cover the operating costs, but it's a good step. It's very important to Cornell to keep this open access. They really don't want to make it subscription, and they do not want to have individual users at this point pay costs at all. So it makes sense to ask, MIT and all the other places that use it to pony up. I think not only is the resource itself very important, but this model is very interesting. Is going to be interesting to watch develop, because it is voluntary. I think that's attractive, but it also asks institutions to say, this resource is something that goes beyond any one institution, and I suspect we're going to be seeing a lot more of that in the future as libraries and universities look at their budgets and say that we just can't support this, but we understand that some greater good. It is definitely a case of putting your money where your mouth is,
Yeah, for listeners who don't know Archive, you can find it at xiv.org, and that's x as in Chi, so archive.org. This is really an amazing resource, and I don't think we have something like it really in the humanities. I think, as you said, Jen, sort of priority, establishing priority and getting results out quickly is very important in the sciences, and this is not something that we humanists are very good at or are very interested in. We tend to hold on to our work until it is honed and crafted and recrafted over and over again. And so I think this is for humanists listening. This is an interesting model of publication that I think we digital humanists can probably learn something from. But I do think it's also an interesting model of sustainability for open access projects, as you said. Dan, what do you think about this new model?
Well, I mean, you know, it underlines how hard and Tom and Mills, I think we all know this being at the Center for History and New Media, is sustainability is really the toughest problem with all digital projects. They're expensive to build, oftentimes expensive to run. I think it's probably the most significant problem we're facing right now, and figuring out sustainable models is incredibly difficult. I do think... In a lot of cases, I've actually said this at a conference, it'd be helpful to have almost a behavioral or social psychologist or economist work with us on some of these things, because what you end up with is, and I think this is completely the case here, is a kind of prisoner's dilemma of how you get, you know, universities not to free ride. And, you know, there are various mechanisms that we've thought of for attacking this problem. They're often very psychological, like shame is a good thing to use, or narcissism. If MIT contributes, they can get a little, you know, MIT as a patron sort of logo on the archive page. I do think this kind of makes sense. I'm interested to see what level the adoption is given the Great Recession. 4,000 is nothing compared to what libraries spend on. This is one of the great secrets of the university, I feel. I'd love to see the Chronicle do a 5-part investigative report on where library budgets go. But there are huge lines. Yes, there are huge lines in library budgets for things like software and subscriptions to, you know, digitized newspapers. And the numbers will, you know, make your jaw drop when you look at that compared to what a university spends on, you know, other things that professors often consider more important. And I often think professors often ask for subscriptions to things without thinking of the cost. So I think there's got to be some reconnection between the way faculty and the university sort of think about buying resources and sort of putting their money where their mouth is, to look around and say, geez, we're spending that much on that one physics journal, and we could be paying literally 1/10 of that to support archive.org, which does, this incredible social good. So I don't know how that, I haven't quite figured out how that reconnection can happen. There has to be some sort of sunlight, I think, on these budgeting issues. But I think there's work to be done in this area. And I am curious to see how this goes at Archive, because if Archive can't do it, I can't imagine, let's say, a smaller humanities or resource that, you know, needs even a tenth of this getting the kind of donations they would need. It's just really a hard problem.
Well, even Cornell was saying that they consider this a short-term solution, not a long-term one. I think what they'd really like to do is get some kind of endowment going that would keep the thing going in perpetuity, or at least into the foreseeable future, and help them do more preservation work with it, because it's also, you know, becoming, it's not just the current research, but everything that's been put in there is obviously an incredibly valuable archive as well, and that's going to take, they'd like to kind of soup that up. So even these contributions, that they know they're not going to be enough, but what the final model will look like, I don't think they know yet. I also asked them whether they could see a point, which archive would take the place of some of these expensive journal subscriptions, and that's a question that librarians do not want to answer on the record, because I think it's very tricky. A lot of the publishers so far have worked very well with archive, and there's a lot of preprint material in there that does then get published formally published in a journal, and so far there's been a kind of coexistence there. But at some point, you know, you have to ask, as Dan was saying, these libraries are, you know, shelling out lots for these journals. How long can that go on? And if researchers can get good versions of that material in some other format, some less formally published way, well, you know, at what point do you say that's the way it's got to go?
Well, on the same question of sustainability, I think we saw another story outside of the Academy, but a story of sort of similar story about sustainability and how you maintain these kinds of cultural resources in the Flickr Commons. Flickr Commons announced this week that they would stop taking new applicants for their Flickr Commons service for the rest of 2010 while they deal with a backlog of applications. And for people who don't know, Flickr Commons is essentially a group on a Flickr group where cultural heritage institutions, libraries, museums, archives can post photographs from their collections and invite Flickr users to comment on those, to help them create some metadata, to create community around those collections, and to generally just engage new audiences around their collections. And you know, several dozen of institutions are now participating in this project. And we saw this week that the other institutions that are interested in joining up won't be able to until at least 2011. Where does that sort of leave Flickr Commons? And this has been a popular project. It's been a project that people have pointed to as a great example of the use of social media in the library, museum, and archive fields. You know, where does that sort of leave Flickr Commons? Any thoughts on that, Mills?
Yeah, this one really scares me a lot because I'm one of the biggest fans of Flickr Commons right from the very beginning. I have been, and I think it's, you know, it's just such a tremendous project. And at the same time, it's embedded in a company, Yahoo, that is struggling. And, you know, this is, although the, you know, the traffic on the Flickr Commons discussions says, oh, no, that's not it. We're so popular that we're backlogged. Well, the fact is, if there was more money to spend, then they would spend the money on processing more members. You know, the problem here is, again, it's like with archive, there's not a revenue stream being generated from Flickr Commons to Yahoo. It's something that they're doing essentially as a social good. And as Yahoo continues to struggle a little in the face of, you know, the big gorilla Google, I'm worried about this project. And because the bigger it gets, the more staff it's going to require. And the staff is very expensive. And if there's not a revenue stream that comes from that, you know, how long can a large corporation continue to fund something like this? And so my only hope is that if this really starts to falter, that they would see the value in the social good and spin the whole thing off in some way. But then the problem still remains. Then you don't have corporate backing for it. Then you have to find the money in some other way. And, you know, Jen mentioned Cornell trying to find an archive money for an endowment. These are hard kinds of projects to find big donations for. And so it's going to be tricky. This story really worries me.
Yeah, it should be said that there is an organization apart from Yahoo called Indie Commons, which works with Yahoo and the Flickr Commons to provide volunteer labor to help organize the commons and to provide a place for people from the collections institutions, that community, to actually have some say and some involvement in what actually the decisions that are made for the commons. And so Yahoo has been, I think, and Flickr has been very, very open about this whole process and really has engaged the community. But as you say, Mills, this is fundamentally, they are a large corporation with a bottom line that has to be their primary concern. Dan, where do you come down on this?
Yeah, well, I mean, I just think back to Tom. I think it was right before you joined me here at the center to work on our September 11th project, the September 11th Digital Archive. And we were in the process of, after 9/11, trying to save born digital materials. And I think it was December of 2001, we heard from someone who had participated in a Yahoo forum, a Yahoo group, where there was a long discussion with hundreds of people sort of expressing their feelings about what happened on 9/11. And they received a notice from Yahoo that Yahoo was going to get rid of all forum posts after 6 months. And there was this sense of, you know, of incredible surprise and shock that they would kind of just delete these things as a matter of policy when there was, you know, a very important outpouring in the fall of 2001. And there's a kind of tone deafness, I think, because of the corporateness of it. Now, it turned out that they actually didn't delete the forums. And I don't know, I guess storage came down in price or something just in time to save it. But, you know, I've seen this time and again over the past decade where, you know, you could think about Google Notebook, which a lot of academics relied on. And it just one day they said, you know what, we're just not doing that anymore. Flickr has never made money for Yahoo. And it just doesn't surprise me that they're going to cut back in this area. So I just think depending on third party for-profit things. I mean, this is not, I'm not trying to be a communist about it. It's just a reality that they're just not in the business, in the long-term business of helping nonprofit units host and care for cultural heritage materials. I mean, I just think we should accept that. I think there's things they do really well, and I've been a very strong advocate for using things like, let's say, Flickr Commons to do some basic crowdsourcing of data. I think that's very impressive. But to imagine that they're anything more than that, or that if you can't get the data back out in a moment's notice in a form that you can use as your own institution, I think you're just kidding yourself. I mean, I could go through a number of examples and take up the rest of the podcast.
Well, but I've been seeing this sort of once a year. Even at Yahoo, when Yahoo bought Flickr, which started as an independent company, they canceled deleted their prior. They had their own Yahoo
Photos. Right, Yahoo Photos.
And
exactly.
They just got rid of it. And there's no reason they can't do this. I guess where I come down on this is that I think people need to know going in what it is and what it isn't. As you said, Dan, I think this is a great place for engaging community, for doing some basic crowdsourcing. I think the idea with Flickr Commons was, well, we're all building all of these websites and, you know, nobody's home, nobody's using them. Why not go to where the users are? If we're going to post photo collections somewhere, why not post them to Flickr where the users are? And it has been a huge success in that regard. I think, you know, thousands and thousands of more people are accessing cultural heritage collections on Flickr Commons than are on many individual museum and library and archive websites. So that's great. And if that's what you're going to use it for, then you should. But you should also know that maybe you shouldn't be diverting staff resources from other things. You know, if you have spare capacity and you understand that this is something that could go away and you're fine with that, you should do that. As long as you understand that this is not a preservation mechanism, and I do fear that maybe some smaller and regional institutions think of this, that this is somehow going to preserve their collections, their digital collections for the long term. As long as you know that this isn't something really that you can count on for the long term, and that this isn't a preservation mechanism. As long as you know that this information that's collected on Flickr Commons, that you may not, even though Flickr has a pretty good API, you may not be able to easily feed that information back into your main collection repository, your collections management system. As long as you know those things, it's a great project. But I think institutions need to go into these projects with sort of full knowledge.
It really seems more like an outreach and audience building mechanism than an archival mechanism per se. And it doesn't really, as Dan was saying, it doesn't really make sense even for an enormous, you know, commercial company to. It doesn't make sense to expect them to, you know, out of the goodness of their hearts, support this very interesting but not profitable venture. You know, much as we'd like them to, but this is something that maybe the museum community or the archival community needs to figure out a way to find some support for. Maybe folded into somebody, you know, it would be great if the Library of Congress could do something, but they have too much on their plate, I'm guessing.
Well, and I think Tom's point is the key one, that it can't be seen as, these kinds of projects can't be seen as preservation projects, that instead it's a way to get people to your main collection And if that's the purpose, okay, and Flickr Commons goes away tomorrow, well, it's very disappointing, but at least there was good exposure for the Smithsonian or the Library of Congress or whoever the participant is. But if that's the only place that their images are residing, then it's a real problem.
Well, okay. Well, in one last story, we noticed this week, we saw that on a couple of stories, actually, on Boing Boing, where we saw that O'Reilly, which had dropped DRM on its publications, and this is I guess is a story for publishing and for questions of academic publishing. O'Reilly dropped digital rights management, so it unlocked its publications. O'Reilly is a large publisher of technology books, handbooks mostly. They did that about 18 months ago, and they saw an 104% increase in sales when they did that. The point I think the Boing Boing article was making is that, you know, when you open things up, you actually make more money. That publishers that are worried about undercutting themselves by opening up their publications should take a look at this and see that you actually can make more money by being open than by being closed. And I think we saw something similar when the iTunes Music Store stopped DRMing its files and opened those up. They actually saw an uptick in sales. Do we see this as is there a lesson here for academic publishing? Is this something that can be extended to subscription databases or to ebooks or textbooks in the academic sphere? Mills, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think it is a good lesson, because I still think that lots of people are going to take things for free if there's no DRM, but lots of people are going to buy too, and especially for academic publishers who, you know, I have to say, I was at a academic conference back in the fall, and I was talking to a publisher's rep, and I said, so, you know, what kind of a press run for a monograph in history would make you happy? And she said, or sales run. And she said, well, you know, 400. And I thought she was going to say 1,000 or 800, but so 400 was just such a shockingly low number that their sales expectations of academic monographs have to be so incredibly low that anything that boosts sales has to be a bonus. And so all the university presses, we've talked about this a lot on the podcast, university presses are in serious trouble. And so if it's working in other markets, like, you know, the other Boing Boing article you mentioned is one I pointed out about Monty Python, Flying Circus guys attacking all the people who had been copying their material and putting it on YouTube. Their response was, oh yeah, well, we'll one up you, we'll put it on our own website in higher quality and we'll give it away. Well, they did, and their sales went way up because people watched it on the website and then said, well, actually, I'd like to own the DVD of that so I can watch it on my own TV and not have, you know, the occasional interruptions from YouTube. And so they've made a lot more money on it. And I think anything that provides additional income to university presses these days has got to be a good thing.
I think they're getting to the point where they're willing to try almost anything, honestly, that they will look at an experiment like this and with a great deal of interest, everybody's starting to see DRM as a, you know, perhaps more of a hindrance than a help. I shouldn't say everybody, but some. And we've also got this Google Editions announcement that came out, I think, at the Digital Book World Conference, in which Google is going to be doing away with digital rights management in this this venture of theirs, which is, you know, may work nicely with the iPad, actually. We'll see, but I think there's a lot of interest in pushing back against DRM.
Right, I think this all ties back to this to the rise of e-readers and the iPad, and I think we will end where we started. We'll have to see what kinds of DRM or open formats are available on that device. Well, we're back with Picks of the Week. We haven't done that in a couple of weeks, I guess. Jen, do you have something for us this week?
Yeah, a couple of things on the iPad and how it could change ebooks. I saw a couple of good stories in the last 24 hours that I think make nice, handy lists of some of the things to think about. One is from Bold Type. It's called Five Ways the Apple iPad Could Change eBooks, and it's a really concise, nice summary of iBookstore pricing, the open source EPUB format that the iPad is supposed to be using, the reading features, what we hope, what the screen may be like to work with, the fact that a lot of publishers, some of the big ones anyway, are buying into this, and the price point. So it's a nice summary. And then the LA Times' Jacket Copy blog, which is a good lit blog, has a post from yesterday called "The iPad Shows Up the Kindle: Will Apple's iBook Store Challenge Amazon?" And it goes into some of these price points and other things that may make Amazon pretty nervous about the iPad. If they're not nervous, they probably should be. So I will send you those links. But those are two nice.
That's great. Yeah.
Summaries.
Yeah, we'll put those in the show notes. I wasn't familiar with the Jacket Copy site. That'll definitely something I'll check out. Dan, you got something for us?
Yes, I have a manifesto this week. it's not my own, but I think it's important for people to read. I saw it from a tweet from Larry Lessig, the law professor and writer on things digital. And he's participating in a sort of global effort called the Public Domain Manifesto. And it's available at publicdomainmanifesto.org, in which there's a bunch of international organizations, a lot of universities and organizations like Creative Commons and the Open Knowledge Foundation in the UK and similar societies who are trying to essentially rebalance some of these copyright principles that have gotten out of whack and trying to reassert the importance of the public domain. Lessig sort of spun off a lot of the thoughts that are in this manifesto in his writing in the New Republic about the Google Book settlement, in which he really worries that because of the nature of copyright, that if you just think beyond Google Books, some of the things that copyright law does to digital works online is making him really uncomfortable. For instance, the fact that Google has to block a lot of the images in books, even if the text is in the public domain, because they're worried that some of the images might not be in the public domain. And so it's a quick read, a couple thousand words, but just really trying to get at how copyright should be rebalanced and the terms of copyright use and fair use. Even if you don't sign it, I think it's an important effort to just take a peek at what they're thinking and some general principles. And I think it's good to get some collaborative work on this front because it's I think, a really critical issue for the 21st century. So Public Domain Manifesto is my pick.
Great, great. Mills?
Well, mine is actually a post from Inside Higher Ed about, and it relates to the issue that Dan raised earlier in the podcast about the actual cost of academic libraries. And this one's called Collections in the Cloud by Joshua Kim, and it appeared about a couple weeks ago now. But I've been thinking about it a lot because I love libraries. I love wandering around in the stacks. And at the same time, with so many books scanned, I keep asking myself, why do we need all of these books here in the building when that's a very expensive proposition and the money could be spent on other things like better teaching and learning resources in the library space, better technology access for students who don't have the money, all of those kinds of things. And so Joshua's piece raises a lot of these questions in a very specific way that I think is really well worth reading because with the press on university budgets, I was listening to the president of the University of California system yesterday on NPR talking about the incredible budget cuts that they've taken, $600-700 million over the last few years. And, the money's got to come from somewhere. And it's got to come not just from one somewhere, but from across the universities. And as much as I hate to say it, I think that having lots of stacks in library buildings is something that my own children are going to miss out on by the time they're my age. It's just not going to be there so much. And so this piece at least tries to lay out some of the specific issues as opposed to just being polemical about it. So I think it's well worth a read.
Yeah, it's a good piece. It's actually, as you said, it's laid out very nicely as kind of a question and answer. piece, and I think it does summarize the issues really well. I've got actually another podcast from a friend of CH&M and a friend of many of ours, from Nancy Proctor. It's the Museum Mobile podcast, it's sort of a set of research notes from Nancy, conversations about meetings she's gone to, issues in the museum world. The latest one is called, just from January 3rd, called Evaluation-Led Mobile Experience Design, comes out of some conversations at the Museum Computing Network Conference in Portland. Nancy is the head of the sort of informal museum mobile group on Twitter, and she is thinking really interesting thoughts about these issues. And so Museum Mobile is a good place to go if you're interested in the future of mobile computing in the museum space. Museum Mobile is a good one. Well, I want to thank all of you, Dan, Mills, Jen, for joining me for my first hosting of Digital Campus. Mills,
I gotta say, Tom, this was just awesome.
Oh, well, it was.
My feet are still up
relaxed?
On my desk. I'm so relaxed.
Well, I'm glad we didn't put you to sleep, coffee. But I guess that could be the coffee, not the conversation. And Mills, you're up next time.
All right. Well, I'm ready.
All right. Well, so thanks to all of you, and thanks to all of you, our listeners. We'll see you again in 2 weeks for another edition of Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself, fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do.